Quoting today's first guest, Andy Breiter paints the picture of why many are involved in regenerative agriculture. It's when I walk through the field and can hear the grasshoppers, see the dung beetles, and listen to the birds. Andy from Gramagrass Livestock in Boulder County is working his livestock on public and private lands to revive the native prairie and also the community. Liz Haney, our second guest, is an original regen rebel. Her expertise as a soil and ecosystem scientist has opened the road to her passion, which is to help improve producer profitability, environmental sustainability, and human health through regenerative practices. I'm Robin with Cultivated Audio for March 2024. Grab those shovels and/or your earbuds and let's dig in. Andy, these days there are so many far-reaching and legitimate reasons for getting into farming and ranching regeneratively. What brought you onto this path?
It actually started with being really interested in cooking food and eating food and having something nice that was nutritious for myself. And as I continued to learn about food, it brought me face-to-face with the reality that the way we produce it, food both uses a large amount of our natural resources and it poisons a lot of our climate. And it made me really curious about that and how can we produce food in a way that's more in line with our ecosystems.
Any seasoned rancher would applaud you for your early attention to comprehensive business planning. And I read that it was kind of wrapped around the opportunity to address land access and management challenges while providing the community with grass-fed and finished beef. What were some of the key points when you started out with your business plan?
Some of the key points were trying to find a niche that was something that wasn't maybe as risky as other opportunities, meaning one of the real challenges for any farmer and specifically livestock producers is the capital expenses to infrastructure and having the live animals. So, for example, to fully finish an animal on grass from gestation in a mom's belly all the way to finishing is over 3 years. And as a new business, I had to figure out a way in which we can start earning money in the meanwhile. And we still don't finish our animals all the way from insemination all the way to slaughter. We work with partner ranches, but you know, working to find that niche and then also really working within relationships and within communities. Some of the owners of the past farms that I work on, you know, they are owners of my business and they helped provide infrastructure in the early days of the business, which made it so I didn't have to necessarily buy this trailer before I was fully ready for it, or I could use their trucks or some other tools of theirs in the meanwhile. And I think that was a really important key step to begin with.
Well, also land is obviously the huge expense if you're not a fourth generational farmer. I was really attracted to this piece of your business plan because here in Boulder County, where you have your livestock, you're on some public land and then you're on private land as well.
Correct. We don't own a single acre of land ourselves, actually. We just lease land from public entities and private landowners and move our cows around across the county to be able to graze in the way that the bison would have grazed. And I think it was definitely a challenge for me personally in my own farming journey of always wanting to own my own farm or something like that, which equated to owning land and being like the only reason why I would necessarily dedicate effort into regenerating properties is if I was building equity in the ownership of the land to begin with. But because of Boulder's unique mosaic of land ownership here, and because of some other reading and learning about some native tribes having a representative of seven generations into the future at their council meetings and things of that nature, I really started to question whether it is a right or whether it's necessary to own land. And it was easily brought into question when we have so much land here that is owned by the public itself. For me, at least, and I think for a lot of my team, understanding that even though we don't own this land, and even though some of these are contracts where we're there for just a year, we know that within what we're doing that year, or hopefully over a longer period of time, if we're doing the best for the land itself, and if we can continue to learn from it and repeat that year after year, but even if it goes away at a certain point, we're still doing the best that we can, and we learn and get better in the moment, then that's as good as you can ask for.
I couldn't agree more. One time I was renting this place, and there was a little bit of space in the backyard, so I was doing gardening, and my neighbor's high school year son saw me working, and he just made me out to be the biggest fool because I didn't even own the property. So that just flew right over his head in the moment. I'm sure he's a changed man now. That was many years ago. In establishing this relationship, you have to graze your cattle on privately owned and public land. Was there a main roadblock in particular that you bumped up against in wanting to do this?
I mean, there were definitely several roadblocks. And to me, I look at those challenges or threats as opportunities. So just really communicating and being active in the community to really share my dream helped get through some of those, of meeting the landowner of where our office and headquarters are and where infrastructure is kept, which is the private landowner who had a Left Hand Valley tree nursery for 30 or 40 years here in Boulder County, and just getting connected through building relationships. And that was a huge hurdle, was getting those headquarters and continuing to build relationships with other owners of land to hopefully continue to communicate them that we're not just trying to take the production from their land.
Right.
And I think that's a continuing challenge because so much of agriculture is about production. It's important that we feed a lot of people, but how we feed them is even more important. And what sort of food we're giving them is really important. But the relationship that has existed for many years between landowner and tenant is, I'm going to pay you for X amount of grass, which means I'm going to try to take as much grass as possible because that's what's happening. So a lot of times now we try to flip some of that relationship to say, actually, you pay us because we're providing a service for the land.
Right.
And that means we're going to do it as some sort of contractor where we're going to do it to the best and really take care of your property, because just like you would with a landscaper, you're paying them to come take care of your property. And obviously some of that agreement goes into the cow's stomach and provides nutrition for them. But rather than having the agreement simply be, I'm paying you, so that means I'm going to take as much as possible because that's how I get what's fair, trying to really create a win-win partnership has helped alleviate some of those challenges.
That's such a great piece of regenerative agriculture's sustainability. Looking back, is there anything glaringly missing in your original business plan? I'm sure it evolved every day almost, but looking back, is there anything that you wished you had thought of or that you could share that proved to be so key?
I think not one specific thing. I guess if I'm the top items on the list that I would say, one is once the snowball started moving forward, things started to really pick up steam. We surpassed some of the milestones that I set out because things just moved a little quicker. So I had to get on top of finding ways to increase our freezer space or have this trailer or increase our cows or things like that a little bit sooner than I was originally planning to, which created a little bit of financial challenges in terms of finding operating loans and other things to increase along with that. The other item that I think has been really interesting, especially over the past few years, that was missing was how much of the business is a business. I got into ranching and cattle specifically because I love working with the animals and I love working out in the field. And as the business has grown in size, understanding, it's a meat business, you know, understanding the spreadsheets that then go with the formulas and whatever else that is associated with that to understand how we can best move the whole animal, because the whole animal needs to be valued, and needing to find somebody to get bones and liver as well as ribeyes. That's been sort of a new challenge. And I think that challenge has evolved to not just one animal at a time, but looking at it through like a learning perspective of how do we do that across a larger scale. And I think that's been a really interesting thing more recently.
Yes. I'm just sitting here smiling, thinking of how successful you've been in just these 4 years. And I know it took a lot of work, not only in the think tank, but also physically. Tell us about your operation, your acreage that you work on, and the number of cattle you have.
Yeah, I mean, I still personally, and this is maybe part of who I am, is challenged. You know, we have had successes over the past 4 years, but really looking at it from like a sustainability perspective, how do we sustain this and really make sure it pays everybody a living wage who's working for the team and all the stakeholders involved really getting value out of it. And I know we've had successes and we try to celebrate those as they come, but also knowing that there's still a ways to go to really build something that's long lasting. I've heard a long time ago from the farmer at Masa Seed Foundation, Rich Pecoraro, mentioning how sometimes farming is like an Olympic sport because you can only do it for so long because it's so physical and it's so go, go, go. So it's one of the challenges I've tasked myself and the business with is looking at it from a longer term perspective and sustainability in that way, as well as with the environment. To answer the question that you did ask, though, last year we grazed about 480 acres across 12 different properties throughout Boulder County. We were as far south as Davidson Mesa, which is on McCaslin Road and basically 36, and as far north as Nelson and 63rd. And we moved the cows around almost once to two times a month between each property. Some properties got hit a couple times just based on how the grass grew. Our average herd size last year was around 40 or so head that we're moving. Obviously, as folks who make beef, that number fluctuates. We have increased our herd probably almost two times this next year.
Amazing. So what does that look like when you're moving them? People that have their own land and they have hundreds or thousands of acres, they have the electric fencing set up and they can change the size and the direction and all of this. And if you're working with these different properties, how does that even work for you?
So we do that same electric fence, a single wire electric fence when we're in a property. We do that every single day. And then about once a month, what we do is we set up a corral and a squeeze chute, a mobile one that we actually were able to get funded through Boulder County's sustainability grant, that we moved to each property and we herd the cattle into the corral and truck and trailer them between each property. And we do it frequently enough where the cows are pretty used to that movement. So we try to make it as low stress as possible. We try to really learn from somebody like Temple Grandin at CSU, or there's another famous stockman named Bud Williams.
Yes.
To really try to work in conjunction with the animals, because we really want to make it safe for both us and for them, and to make it as low stress as possible. Once a month, you'll see us herding animals into a corral and truck and trailer them, about 10 to 15 animals at a time to each property. And we don't always make the long drive from Nelson all the way to 36. And we sort of jump between property, make our way one way and then the other way.
I'm so happy that you have the support of Boulder County to do that. Tell me what you've seen as far as the soil actually regenerating. What are some things you're noticing?
As the ranch is very new, and like I said, some of these properties were only more recently on them. So, you know, soil really changes at a longer scale in time. You know, it takes like 3 to 5 years at least to see some of the fluctuations simply from weather start to take into effect.
Sure,
and the longer time you can study the soil, the more you can actually see trends. So it's hard to totally say, but I look for other leading indicators that help us see, is there a higher percentage of live plants growing in the field?
Right.
As an example. And that's one of my favorite indicators to look at, because that means that that live plant is photosynthesizing. So that's one thing. And other things, just for my own emotions, is looking at different grasses in the field as we walk around and seeing, even if it's just a small clump of switchgrass or side oats grama grass, these native warm season grasses that you don't really see in much abundance here anymore, seeing those and then trying to protect those from getting overgrazed and making sure their seeds spread. Those are some indicators that make me feel really good. And hopefully we see trends over time continue to develop to see more and more of those.
And what kind of wildlife are you seeing out there? Do you ever have any coyotes or mountain lions coming into your properties and having any trouble with that?
The coyotes are everywhere, I guess. Coyotes are not really a predator to cattle. Cattle are a little too big for the coyotes, but I enjoy hearing them sing at night and seeing them in the field. And it's always so interesting how the cows just stand there and the coyote just runs right through them. See a lot of raptors. We saw a bald eagle just yesterday in the field, which is always so nice. On the home place near Niwot, we had a herd of about 100 elk that was running up and down Left Hand Creek this year, which for me was really nice to see. I mean, it's all part of an ecosystem. And I think sometimes we take farming and agriculture, we set it aside from the ecology of what's happening around it. And sometimes elk, as an example, can be looked at as a little bit of a terror for agricultural fields. But I always really appreciate seeing them running through the fields.
And Andy, I just want to ask you another question about the soil before we move on. What signs do you look for when knowing it's time to let a certain field rest? And are you reseeding cover crops?
So actually, the question is more about when is it time to come back? So because we're already moving the animal so frequently, we're not allowing the grass a chance to regrow and then get eaten a second time after it's regrown before it's ready to be eaten again, because that's what would cause overgrazing. So it takes sometimes between 3 and 5 days after a cow or any other animal has eaten a piece of grass during the growing season for that grass to start to regrow again. So it's taking its energy from the roots that it's stored there to really start to send out its leaves, its solar panels again. And if that cow or whatever other animal gets a second bite on that grass prior to it fully regrowing, to it fully having enough solar panels where it can start to take more energy and bring it back to its roots, then we'd overgraze. And because we move the animals once every day, we're moving them along quick enough where we're not allowing them to get that second bite. And the growing season and weather, water specifically, helps us determine when it's time to come back. So sometimes it could be 30 days or 28 days where you can come back. If it's got plenty of water, the plant does, its peak growing season, it's May or June or something like that. Other times it could be 160 days or 300 days. It just sort of depends on some other factors in terms of what our goals are for each property. But that's really what we focus on. And then we do a lot of different trials with reseeding native grasses and cover cropping as well. We do work in land that has significant prairie dog populations, and we're working with different folks to see if using plants like sorghum sedan grass and other things can help cover the soil and passively move the prairie dogs away from those properties, as having prairie dogs out of balance can cause some issues with soil erosion and some other problems.
Yes, I could certainly see that. And the name of your ranching is grama grass. Is that more nutritious, or do you find the cattle will gravitate more toward that type of grass, or is that the natural grass that was most prevalent at one time in this area?
Yeah, blue grama grass is the state grass of Colorado, and it is a warm season grass. So you can really categorize grasses in two main factors, cool season grasses and warm season grasses. And the predominant green grass that you see growing, especially in the springtime, is actually an introduced grass called brome grass. And what happens is it's highly palatable. It's really nutritious in the springtime. But come summer, you need to irrigate it really heavily. Mm-hmm. And or it simply goes to seed and no longer becomes as nutritious. And it's really not happy growing in the peak of our summer months. And it causes a lot of issues with other competition coming because it's really a sod-based grass. So if you look at adding warm season grasses, which is like a blue gramma grass or a side oats gramma grass or any other gramma grass or big blue stem or anything else, it's trying to increase the overall palatability of a field across a longer period of time than just the spring or just in the fall when these cool season grasses are happy. And my imagination takes me a couple different places when thinking about what the prairie looked like. It had a combination of both cool and warm season grasses, so plants would be happy in the middle of August or in June or in April. And that some years there was heavier rain in the summer, and some years there were wetter winter and more flooding coming down, which would help the cool season grasses. And one of the things I like to say a lot, because it makes me feel good, is that there's songs that talk about amber waves of grain. If you look at a big blue stem grass or a blue gramma grass or any of these warm season grasses, they have more of an amber hue. So they don't necessarily just turn brown. They have this amber color to them. And, you know, that's the grass that was part of this native environment that has sort of been kicked out. And to have a grass like that that doesn't actually need as much water as some of the cool season grasses that can still survive in the hot summer months, I think is a key component to our ecosystem and really creating resilience.
Yeah, what a great focus, especially here when we can get lost in a drought for a little while. Thank you for doing all of this. This is amazing. Tell us about the Shared Living Collaborative.
So the Shared Learning Collaborative has been a project that we've been working on. There's five other entities involved, and it's looking at, can we have viable agriculture in the presence of prairie dogs? And it's been a really good collaborative project because we have a lot of different perspectives that are coming to the table and saying, we all want the land to be healthier. Now, we might not all say that this equals a healthier land, but we can still come to the field a few times a year. We can still decide on a management plan for this project. We can learn together about how does this trial impact the land and how does this trial do that, and actually find a way to have really positive communication, even if there's at the base a conflict around prairie dogs. How do you manage for prairie dogs? So it's been a really interesting project, both on a personal level in terms of getting to know people who have vastly different perspectives across the board, and from a level of understanding how do we really increase our skill set in managing properties that don't have a lot of live plants or have other factors like a high occupancy of prairie dogs or have a lot of brome grass that's really not very productive right now. Some brome grass can be, but some is not. What I was mentioning about a personal level about it is looking at the society at large is that happens across the board on so many different issues. And if we can still find a way to compromise, maybe not on every single property, because that would not allow as much agriculture to happen as is needed. But even on examples to show that we can work together, that's a really positive thing. And you know, whether it's prairie dogs in this county, or we have had a lot of debates about GMOs as another example, I think it shows the folks in Boulder really care about how we're using the land. And I think it's something that our city and county and other cities around who have open space programs should be really proud of, is that the citizenry really does care. And it's a question of how do we then take that care to really make sure that we're using the land to the best of its ability.
Yes, absolutely. And you're right on with the amount of citizen awareness and care for these kinds of issues, which I'm really happy about. At its heart, regenerative farming is community at its best. What about this whole experience do you see as really being a great building block in your life and for your project as well?
That's a very loaded and tough question. I think for me, it's seeing and hopefully continuing to see a community of farmers who are able to really sustain themselves here. And so many of us are doing such cool work, whether it's Artemis Flower Farm or Speedwell Farm and Gardens over at the Boulder Treehouse Collective, where they're working collaboratively on one property together, farming in different sections, or Bluebird Sky Farmstead or Massa Seed Foundation, or my old boss is the Golden Hoof. You know, seeing that community as a whole is something that I'm proud of, and I hope we can continue to build together and not necessarily be in competition with each other to be able to sell our product to the market and saying there's only so much market. I spent a lot of time working with the Flatirons Farmers Coalition. I still am a member of the organization, work with them continually, is really proud of that organization for that sort of work of how do we really make a go of this for the long run, because we're all first-generation farmers. None of us really own land. And what is the future of farming? And we're defining that.
You certainly are, yes. Andy, what is your favorite cut of meat?
Oh, that favorite cut changes almost almost weekly at this point as I get to try a new one. And I love the taste of the meat that we produce is just so complex, and there's so much depth to that taste that it really feels nutritious. Obviously, I have a bias for that, so it changes. Like, I just cooked some beef cheek tacos recently, and the cheek meat was so unctuous, so much different flavor to it, and fatty, but not too fatty. That's what's coming to mind right now.
All right. And Andy, I know, and you mentioned this at the beginning, so we're sort of going full circle here, but I know the fact that Boulder is quite a center for natural, high-end food, and there are so many restaurants in the area that are being fed by folks like you and your efforts. So thank you for all of that. It's really interesting to speak with you because you are doing this in a slightly different way than being a second or third or fourth generation farmer, and it's beautiful what you're building. So thank you.
I appreciate that, and I think really, it's comments like that that are so important that I almost have to say thank you in return from like a really sincere place, because I know from experience toiling in the soil and hard day's work can be really tiring. And when we're at the Boulder County Farmers Market and people come up to us and share how much they enjoyed our product, or they come out to a land walk, which is an education event that we have, you know, those are the real folks that help drive us, and it's so mutual in that appreciation.
Liz, your reputation precedes you, but for the benefit of our audience, please share your background and a short introduction to soil regen.
Okay. Hi, I'm a soil scientist and ecosystem scientist. My husband developed the Haney Soil Health Test, and I helped him work on that. I have a background in mine soil reclamation, watershed modeling, and doing educational conferences and stuff, soils consulting. So a few years ago, I was working a corporate job, and after COVID, got together with my business partner, Russell Hedrick. We started Soil Regen. Quit working for corporate, and we wanted to really bring education to producers all the way from big soil health events to on the ground consulting, and really tie together all the education about regenerative agriculture and soil health and help the farmers along their journey till, you know, they could then become mentors as well. So that's a lot of what we do at Soil Regen. We help companies transition their growers from conventional to regenerative, help make farm plans. We do product evaluation from a soil health perspective. So a lot of what we do is based on soil testing, soil health, and all the regenerative practices.
You know, something I wasn't necessarily going to ask you, but since you mentioned the mining soil reclamation, what have you been able to learn from that in order to really feed into the regenerative process? There must have been a few things that popped up and sort of went from A to B or linked in.
Yeah, so I worked for a regulatory agency for the state of Texas regulating their mine soil reclamation plans, all the companies. So in Texas, we do surface mining for coal and lignite. So they're taking off 20, 30 feet of soil and bedrock and everything to get to this coal. And what they were doing was mixing this and calling it overburden and mixing all those really bottom layers with the top layers. And what this does, it can cause like acid forming materials to come to the top. And it's just a very unnatural system. So I did learn a lot about really preserving and conserving your topsoil and how important that is to reestablishing growth or plant growth in general. And that's what we focus on in regenerative agriculture. It's protecting our topsoil. We don't want to lose it for erosion, wind erosion, water erosion. We want to maintain and build on that biological life in the soil so that it continues to produce and help plant growth in any situation, pasture or row crop.
And we all know, of course, that cover cropping is essential to regenerative farming. And you've got some pretty hefty numbers and percentages that I believe you could share regarding just how important it can be. And I'm wondering, when these measurements are taken from, say, ground that was not cover cropped, and then the next year it was cover cropped, do the nutrients and the actual life in the soil, do they go exponential that first year and then level off, or is it a gradual process all the way through?
Well, it's variable and it can be gradual because soil biology is always changing. Yeah. And climatic conditions are always changing. It's going to vary naturally throughout the year, throughout the day, year to year. But when we see people who are using cover crops versus the fallow system, we do see that the soil biology comes back stronger and earlier in the spring. And then over time, it also develops a greater population and diversity within the soil, which helps to, if you're growing a crop and you have a really diverse set of microbes in the soil, right when you need some nitrogen, you might be able to get that from your diverse microbial species in the soil. Or if it's a time when you need boron, you know, all these things can work together. So cover crops are important in not only activity, but diversity below ground as well.
Yeah, I just heard something for human health that was saying when there's a lack of boron, you don't get the uptake really of vitamin D from the sun. And I'm wondering, is that something you've heard in relation to soil?
No, I haven't really heard that, but it makes sense since all of our soils are pretty much mineral depleted.
Yes.
Starting back since the industrial agricultural revolution, we've been pretty much depleting our soils. Now, a lot of people might think that's because we're growing crops on them. But what it is that it's the way in which we're growing the crops on them.
Yes.
So if we want to return any of those minerals and nutrients back to the soil, we need to do it, be cropping, be running our pastures in as much of a natural way as we possibly can. That way we're returning nutrients back to the soil.
Yes. And the NPK formula has been the industrial ag's formula for success. Having a regen focus, how do you think about creating balance in soils?
So we focus a lot. We still focus on NPK, but we also test and measure and focus on micronutrients throughout the Haney test. And then what we like to focus on mostly is the organic portions in that soil. As we see soils become more and more healthy, they have more organic nitrogen available, more organic phosphorus available. The soil really starts to function in nutrient cycle in a much more efficient manner. And so nutrient availability increases with your soil health. I think I may have gone off the rails there a little bit. But
no, that's fine.
That was
but
my thought process.
But it makes me want to ask you, when you're speaking availability, is there one particular thing that unlocks or begins to unlock and make those nutrients available Or is that too broad a question?
Well, the one thing is the microbes in the soil. Once you start unlocking them and building that population, that's the key to it. That's the key to increasing nutrient availability and the total amount of nutrients in the soil as well.
Yes, yes. I spoke to a man recently who heads up the United States CO2 Coalition, and he said that although he gardens organically, he firmly believes chemical nitrogen fertilizer is needed in order to feed the world. And I might also add that I had the pleasure of telling him about regenerative agriculture. He had never heard of the phrase regenerative agriculture, which blew my mind. Yes. But anyway, now he knows about it and he's had an article sent to him as well. But on saying that, can you comment on this about the necessity of nitrogen fertilizer? Is it needed in the world? Is it needed for a little while, do you think? But we can come back to a totally natural system. What do you think about that?
I think that because the way that our food system is set up, that right now we cannot completely eliminate any type of fertilizers. We can decrease the use and become more efficient with them. But we're in a system where we can't really all go 100% organic. It's harder to farm that way, and production will be lower. And in order to feed the world, we're going to have to use some fertilizers, some chemicals to keep these crops going, because it's going to be almost impossible, especially in a row crop situation, to go 100% back to nature. Most of the row cropping was prairie land, let's say in the Midwest. We're not going to go back to where the bison were running. So the best we can do is just try to mimic it and reduce the use as much as we can so that we can really focus on the return on investment for the farmers. I want rural America to thrive. I want people to want to come back to the farm. So I want the farmers to have the best return on investment. And sometimes that requires fertilizer so that you can actually grow the crop.
So what is the number one key thing that comes to mind to you to really decrease the amount of chemical fertilizer? And you can talk about potassium or nitrogen, whichever one you want.
Well, adding organic matter to the soil is critical for increasing any type of nutrient availability. And I don't mean total organic matter. It has to be this water extractable organic carbon portion, which is the microbes food source. So we want to increase soil organic matter overall, but we also want to make sure that there's a healthy food source for the microbes to eat. Because when they eat those carbon compounds, that's when they release nitrogen, phosphorus, that kind of thing. When we have healthy soils because we've increased carbon, we can increase the availability of things like potassium, because they may not be trapped in clays as much as they would be, because we have a more balanced system, that the soil is functioning as it should because it's getting enough air and water. So carbon is super critical for all these processes.
Yes, of course. And I know the Haney soil test is a whole interview, but just how do you, with the Haney soil testing, address the fact that, as you mentioned first in this interview today, that there are so many factors? There is the climate, there is the water, there's the water in the soil when you test it, actually. So even though it might show a certain amount of nutrients, so many other things come in to create healthy soil where you are. Where I am in Boulder, Colorado is going to be different, obviously, than where you are in Texas.
Yeah. When we look at a Haney test, one of the first things I look at is microbial activity. And then the second thing I look at is their food source, which is that water extractable organic carbon. Once I look at those numbers, I can sometimes see, okay, do we have a healthy microbial population? Are they running out of food? Do they have enough of that food source? And I look at the carbon to nitrogen ratio, the organic carbon to organic nitrogen ratio, because we want to see if the soil's balanced. When we can look and see if the soil's balanced, we can see how the management practices are affecting the soil. another way we do this, we have a regenerative verification program. So we can test the soils to see if they're actively being regenerated through different management practices. And what we do is we compare a 0 to 6 inch sample, which is that active management zone, to a 6 to 12 inch sample, which would be your baseline under your management conditions, under your context, under your climate, and no matter where you are. That 0 to 6, if it's healthier and more robust than that 6 to 12 inch, we can tell if you're improving your soils through management practices. And then we can take that information, provide fertility recommendations. We can look at the carbon and nitrogen ratios, see maybe what cover crops would be needed the next year, see if any adjustments need to be made to pH. It's pretty all-encompassing, and all of the whole tests works together to inform us on the whole system. It's not the end-all, be-all test. There's other tests that are also very valuable, but we can generally get a really good picture of what's going on through all the different parameters in the test.
Now, I don't know if this would be a question for your husband, Rick, who you developed this test with, but I would hate to see all of the soil whisperers, all the old farmer techniques for looking at their land to figure out what it is they need. Do you see that totally going by the wayside? Do you feel like you can now, perhaps because of using the soil test, you can actually use that in reverse and look at soil and go, well, I think this needs to be done or this needs to be added?
We can tell a lot from the test, but the most important thing, and we always tell our farmers and ranchers this, the most important thing you can do is get out there and observe and test and try and do different things on your own land so that you can see how it's going to affect you, because everybody's operation is different. Everybody's labor restrictions are different. So there's not like one prescription for anybody. They need to get out there and see what their soil looks like. They need to be in touch with it. And most growers I know are and do that. I do know some very conventional growers that have large acreages that they just can't step a foot on every single piece of land.
Sure.
Just because it's too time restricted. But it'd be great if they could.
Yeah. Well, I know I live in a bubble talking to regenerative farmers and ranchers, but you have a broader view with all of the folks that you connect with. At this point, do you see glaring misunderstandings about regenerative agricultural practices that are still held?
The arguments we hear about regenerative agriculture are that it won't work here. It might work over there, but not here, even if it's across the street. Or that cover crops take up too much moisture or retain too much moisture in the soil. So there's some basic arguments that people make against regenerative agriculture, but we're working to address those issues. We have all of these educational events all throughout the country. So example, I'm having one next week in, or week after next in Dodge City, Kansas. We're bringing in people to speak to the farmers that are coming there that are from their area and beyond. And then we also bring in the scientists to back up what these producers are telling the audience about their operations. So we really try to tie in the whole picture. Like one person, Darren Williams, might be growing diverse cover crops and deer food plots. And he actually has really nice bucks on his land and better wildlife diversity because of his practices. And then we can back that up with the science with, we've looked at his soils and look at what his soils look like as well. So the above ground things that they're seeing on their farm, we can look down deeper into the science behind it and see why it's working. It addresses it, yeah.
You know, speaking of the science, I think there's a side effect to scientific research, and it's reductionist thinking. And certainly it happens. I'm sorry?
Yeah, I'm laughing because I talk about that in my talks, but go ahead.
Yeah, I've been involved with alternative medicine and practices in that field for a long time, and there is a side effect of that. And I think, honestly, we could all see that in our day. We could catch ourselves being in that mode of reductionist thinking, even though we're totally unconscious of it. What is it about regenerative agriculture that can really bump us out of that while still using the science? It's a tightrope walk, yeah. I think.
Yeah, it is. And I'm a scientist, but I think of things in a holistic way. And so does my husband, who's also a scientist, because we want to see the big picture. But we were trained academically under that reductionist thinking approach. And what is so fantastic about regenerative agriculture is that all the pieces fit, and we can see it and we can observe it. So it's not just a straight crop response to applying nitrogen fertilizer, which would be a reductionist way of looking at things. What we look at as scientists in this field, and what the producers are looking at that are practicing these practices, they're looking at a holistic system. So not only are we looking at the soil, we're looking at the plant growth and crop yield and greenness and things we can observe with our eyes or by harvesting. But we also do total biomass measurements on cover crops. We do nutrient testing, tissue testing throughout the growing season. So it's looking at all the different factors. And what I really think is so cool about regenerative farmers is that they sit down and think how all these processes are working together and really farm with their brains. And then we just can come in as scientists and help figure out how to explain why that's happening and why it might be happening. So regenerative agriculture is a really nice blend of practical thinking on the ground with good science.
Yes. Do you see Regen Ag getting caught in its own web and getting stuck anywhere? I mean, organic kind of got stuck because it wasn't sustainable ultimately, right? I just want to see it continue to be its clean and responsive self.
What I think is so interesting, and it shocked me, the reason I'm in a vehicle right now driving is I just left the Commodities Classic conference in Houston, which is the largest ag conference in the world. And I thought, I'm going to walk into this place. There's 12,000 attendees. I'm not going to know a single soul. It's going to be all industrial agriculture. And I walked in and I immediately knew people. A lot of the companies I work with were there. And regenerative agriculture was a very hot topic and discussed at all of the booths that I went to. And it surprised me. It's taking off. And it's because it's not restrictive. Like organic is restrictive. Regenerative is not a restrictive set of checkboxes. It's farming in nature's image to the best of our ability under our own circumstances. What regenerative agriculture does is it regenerates the soil, it regenerates your crop, it regenerates your family, it regenerates the community. It can get bogged down if we try to define it too coarsely. I just feel like it's taking off more than it is being restricted.
Oh, nice. And generally, I'll ask a rancher what their favorite steak is, but I want to ask you about your Farmers Reserve distillery. You're taking care of business in many ways here, Liz.
Yeah. So Farmers Reserve Distillery is a farmer-owned distillery that we have. Anybody in ag production or that helps ag production can be a part of it. But what we do is we distill regenerative verified grains into yummy, tasty bourbons and whiskeys.
Nice. Well, is there anything in closing you'd like to share with us? We covered a broad set of questions, but there's so much more, of course.
No, I guess if you'd like to add my contact information, our website's agsoilregen, REGEN.com. And my email is liz@agsoilregen.com. So if anybody has any questions or follow-up, I can feel free to reach out.
Thank you, Liz Haney and Andy Breiter. We can be found at cultivatedaudio.com and wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for being here and for helping make here where we all want to be.